KZSU-FM Stamford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. Indeed, the last show for the summer quarter on KZSU's schedule. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining today on the show. Today, I'm excited to have on Professor Susan Shirk, who is an expert in China's media policy, a very interesting topic. She's a professor at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at UC San Diego and a Homi Lam Endowed Chair in China-Pacific Relations and the director of their Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. Susan has edited a fascinating book that I came across last year, and I'm very excited to have her on the show. The book is called Changing Media, Changing China. And in this book, Susan has gathered a variety of scholars, both Chinese scholars and others who focus on China's media policy and Chinese media more broadly, and examines in this book a variety of topics ranging from how the economic structure and business world in China relates and deals with both the mainstream media as well as government media, environmental journalism, engineering, and so forth. Our focus today is going to be primarily on the chapter that Susan authored in the book, whose title is Changing Media, Changing China, and we're going to take a look at what those policies are. In reading this book, I learned quite a bit, and for those that follow technology and specifically, we hear often, and certainly a popular topic of discussion, are filtering technologies and efforts to in one way or another, hold back or quash certain types of expression on the internet in places like China and others, as well as the human rights issues that arise. And on the flip side of that, of course, is the boom in Chinese exports and the growth of their economy as a consumer economy and how those two policies interact. This book focuses and takes as its perspective what those policies are. And so our focus today is going to be based upon and drilling down on the policies as opposed to the technologies. We've had on Hearsay Culture a number of guests in the past who have discussed the technological aspects of this, including people like Professor Paul Ohm at the University of Colorado, who focuses on filtering, as well as others like Oliver Day from the Berkman Center at Harvard and Derek Bambauer at Brooklyn Law, who have written about hacking and those kinds of technologies. We'll have other people on in the future to talk about those things. But here today, we're going to take a broader look at the policies behind the use of those technologies. And this is, again, a fascinating topic, one that I've wanted to cover on the show for quite a while. And with Susan's book, Changing Media, Changing China, we have that opportunity. By way of a brief background, as I mentioned, Susan is the director of the Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. She first traveled to China in 1971 and has been doing research there since. Among other experiences in her professional career from 1997 to 2000, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, where her responsibility includes China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Mongolia. She's founded the Northeast Asia Cooperation Dialogue, which is an entity that does track to discussions of security issues amongst a variety of U.S. and Pacific Rim countries. She's authored several books, of which Changing Media, Changing China is only the most recent, and she's also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She is joining us via Skype from her home, and Susan, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Let's
nice to be here.
My pleasure. Let's start off with a question I ask most of my authors. Tell me about the genesis of your interest in China and Chinese media.
Well, my interest in China, that's a long story because I've been at it for a very long time. I started studying China when I entered college many years ago, and I was when no American could go to China or do research in China, but then I was very fortunate in being able to visit China as one of the first Americans right after the ping pong team in 1971. And I have been able, therefore, to do research in China ever since. I was fascinated by China starting off fascinated by Chinese history, and then it was the Cultural Revolution, that campaign that Mao launched between 1966-1976, when he had this vision of the kind of society he wanted to create, and mobilized the Red Guards to attack party officials. It was a pretty crazy and confusing time that I wanted to understand better. So I started studying China way back then. But my interest in the media is more recent. I've studied a lot of different topics over the years, but how I started studying media was that after I came back from Washington, having served in the State Department and worked on U.S.-China relations, I felt that I, even though I'm a student of China's internal politics, that I really needed to write a book on U.S.-China relations. But I was interested in the connection between China's domestic situation and the way it behaves in the world. So I wanted to look inside China and the foreign policy process and public opinion and how it was affecting Chinese international behavior. So I started interviewing journalists, and I thought, now, this is really fun, because compared to interviewing officials in China, it's so much more interesting to talk to journalists in China today, because they actually tell you something. They're candid. They generally have a kind of critical stance toward the political system. And as it turns out, the changes in the media and their impact on public opinion, especially the way they stimulate nationalist sentiment, turns out to be a very important part of the story of Chinese foreign policy. And because the leaders of China, the Communist Party leaders, are actually very insecure, politically insecure, especially after 1989, Tiananmen crisis, when there were demonstrations in more than 130 cities throughout China. The leadership split on how to respond, and only because the military came in and followed orders and put down the demonstrations forcibly did the regime survive. And of course, in 89, also the Berlin Wall fell, and other communist governments in the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, started to topple. So since 89, China's leaders have worried that their own days in power are numbered, and this makes them very attentive to public opinion, because they're watching to see whether or not the public supports what they're doing. They're very worried about a repeat of Tiananmen and widespread unrest. So what this means is that the media, the internet, are a source of information for them, since they don't have elections to give them information about what the public thinks about them. They turn to the media and the internet. And so you get this kind of feedback loop of the media and internet stimulating nationalism, and the nationalist sentiment then creates a kind of pressure on the leaders to take a tough stand on certain issues that the public's paying close attention to. So that's a kind of long-winded explanation of how I then started working on media and internet in domestic politics. I had first focused on it as part of my research for my book, China, Fragile Superpower, about the domestic drivers of foreign policy in China.
having looked at China for 40 years and seen the change in the society, not only as a result of the fall of the wall in Europe, but also the advent of technology, I'm curious, at least at a top level, because we're going to dig more deeply through the course of the interview, to get your opinion on what you see as the most significant change in how media is used in China, putting aside for the moment the internet. Is there a policy shift that you've seen over the course of time, and one that we'll drill down on in the show, but at a top level, this idea of changing media, changing China, calls for that basic question?
Well, yes. In 1979, as part of the market reform and opening, China's leaders also allowed the media, which previously had been entirely financed and controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, to commercialize, to go to the market. I'm still puzzled by whether or not they understood the consequences of this fateful decision. I've done interviewing, and it still remains something of a puzzle to me, because they did it at the same time as they allowed other types of units like hospitals and schools to also raise more of their own revenue. And certainly part of the reason they did that was that the central government had budget issues, and they wanted to require these units to earn more of their own funding. So once you allow a newspaper or a magazine or a television station to sell papers and to sell advertising, and therefore to try to attract a broader audience, you're changing the incentives of the media for the kind of stories they want to print, and that search for audiences changes the whole media system. So I think that's been absolutely crucial, and even if there had been no internet, I think it would have changed China's political life.
With regard to the book itself, and as I mentioned in the introduction, you have a number of authors who have made contributions to this work. How did you select the authors in terms of the criteria that you used to find and identify the right scholars for this work?
Well, I had gotten to know some crusading Chinese journalists, and I thought that it would be really interesting to bring them together with people who study Chinese politics to talk about how the media was changing China. So I wanted to mix the on-the-ground practitioners, the people working in the trenches, with the foreign experts and see how our perspectives differed or resembled one another. So that was really the idea. The person on the Chinese side that I work very closely with in getting the whole project going is a remarkable editor, journalist and editor named Hu Shuli, who has won a lot of international awards for freedom of the press. And she, for about 15 years now, has led the leading finance and economics magazine in China. Now she's got another publication, but it's in the same space. And she's really the person who helped introduce me to some of these other people, and others were just folks that I'd already interviewed and met.
Now, and we're chatting with Professor Susan Shirk on Hearsay Culture in KZSU FM Stanford. These journalists, and of course, you know, to the extent that an American audience, or although the show has an international audience, but the extent that we read about China in the context of media policy in the United States, we regularly hear, to the extent we read about it, we regularly hear about filtering and risks to journalists and so forth. And I'm curious, as we get into some of those issues, to ask you whether the authors who have made contributions here to this work have put themselves at risk in any way, which gets us to a more detailed discussion of this idea of changing media and changing China. Have they taken risks by making these contributions?
I don't think so. First of all, publishing in the United States in English is much less risky than publishing in Chinese inside China. And also, I think we underestimate how much lively debate there is inside China. And I assure you that all of these folks are saying things that they have said many times inside China as well.
And that gets us to a bedrock question, which I think is helpful to contextualize the discussion. In terms of the structure of Chinese media, and I know that that question is extremely broad and would take the rest of the hour, but in terms of size, readership, how would you describe the current state of Chinese media in 2011?
Well, the most people in China get their news from television. So television penetration is pretty well universal. The internet has over 480 million people getting their information from the internet, which of course is only about 30% of the population. So it's a large group, but it remains a minority of people, and most of those people are younger, better educated, and live in the cities. Newspapers and magazines are very good businesses in China, unlike many countries in the West, where they're financially struggling. And you know, it's really hard to know exactly how many newspapers and magazines there are. The statistics are not very good, but certainly many thousands of newspapers and magazines. So in cities where you used to have just one or two official papers, now you'll have evening popular newspapers, tabloids, as well as the official newspapers. So news media, very lively space in China, a lot of ways that people can get their information. But I think it's important to emphasize that television is certainly the way that most rural people get their information. Internet penetration in the rural areas is not that extensive. And so television ends up being the medium that is the most tightly controlled because it has the broadest impact.
Now, these controls, and again, without talking about the technology in detail, include filtering, but they also, from reading a book, include much more traditional ways of controlling the media. So I'm curious, in terms of the structure, again, this is the basic infrastructure before we get in some details of the policy. How does China, and what collection of tools does it use to control the media? Where does it find its most useful levers?
Well, first of all, you can't have a publication or a news portal without getting a license. And there are a limited number of licenses. And so the government and the Communist Party propaganda authorities, that's where they get their first chance to control you, is by awarding you your license or having the ability to take it away and shut you down. The second thing is that pretty much, let's leave out the internet now. Newspapers, magazines are part of media groups that are led by official party publications. But these party publications then have created media groups to diversify and get more revenue with all sorts of magazines and newspapers. But the appointment of the top editor of all these publications is still controlled by the Communist Party officials, or in these official media groups. There are very, very few truly private publications in China. There are a few, but very, very few. Television, it's, again, it's all under the local governments, or CCTV is right under the Chinese Communist Party, the China Central Television. That's one way, or two ways, the licensing and then the fact that the appointment of the senior most person in each medium publication is controlled by these official media groups. And then the third way is, of course, the propaganda apparatus at the central level and at local levels that sends around guidance about content, about what not to report or how something should be reported. And those notifications come through every day. And then lastly, I think you have to say something about self-censorship, because editors and journalists can lose their job if they cross the line to critical story that the propaganda officials think is, you know, really crossing a line. So even before we get into the various technologies of controlling content on the internet, we have these more traditional ways of censorship and controlling the journalist and their publications.
And with regard to those technologies that add this additional layer, aside from filtering, what else is China doing in terms of maintaining that control?
Well, basically every publication, print, television, and online, is responsible for its own content. So what this means is that a lot of the censorship of making sure that articles don't go too far in criticizing the party, especially the central party, the national party, they're much freer at criticizing local officials. So the way that is done is that all the responsible people, the people in charge of those publications, are taking personal responsibility for it. So they have a pretty extensive operation, say with the news portals, if something gets on that shouldn't be on, you know, an hour, even less time later, it will get taken off. So the hand of the censor is particularly visible in online news. With television and print, people don't really know what stories didn't make it. Mm-hmm. But with the online media, they may see a story and then see it disappear shortly afterwards, and then to be followed by some postings that may be framing the story in a way that is very positive about what the government and the party are doing. And that's a third element, which is to pay people to post their own remarks, their own comments that are pro-government ones. So there's a lot of manipulation of content on the internet. It's very visible to everyone. And I think that's really of tremendous significance, because I think it really does undercut respect for the party when people can see in a very visible way the hand of the censor, the party censor, the propaganda authorities on the internet.
And you know, it's an interesting point there, Susan, because one of the aspects of the Chinese media landscape that you and a few of the others focus on in the book is the stark difference in the Chinese government's position with regard to filtering, censorship, and ultimate control of the media when the media is discussing economic versus political scenarios. And it's a fascinating distinction that I want to explore a bit also after the break, but at least to start off, describe that in a little more detail, because this the book fleshes this out, and I'm not sure that I'm confident that most people are not aware of this distinction.
Well, actually, the Chinese Communist Party has made a pretty bold decision to open up access to news, including from abroad, in lots of topics, not just economics, but technology, sports, culture, you know, personalities, movie stars, you know, with many Chinese people can really learn pretty much all the same things that you and I can learn from the internet when it doesn't involve politics. But on topics that do touch on politics, they're much more nervous, much more worried. Of course, their definition of politics is pretty expansive. You know, it can include things related to religion, for example, or it can include some foreign economic policy, like the exchange rate. So, you know, they try to manage content whenever it is an area that they feel could stimulate widespread criticism of Communist Party rule or the central leadership.
We're chatting with Professor Susan Shirk of UC San Diego, editor of the book Changing Media, Changing China, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that the show is on KZSU, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to KZSU as well as Hearsay Culture. Susan, that point that you've made there gets to this kind of targeted control of media, which seems so critical to how China manages the message ultimately that the press sends out to the public, and to the extent that one uses the internet via not only traditional media but blogs and other citizen media type outlets. Is it fair to say that China's policy is extremely fine-grained on that point, that it's not the blunt instrument that we've seen other countries use, like, for example, Egypt, when it shut down the internet, primarily to kill communication, but shut down all forms of communication, good, bad, or indifferent? It seems like China is using the scalpel rather than the saw or the hammer. Is that a fair statement?
It is, although there are exceptions. You know, when there were violent demonstrations in the far western province of Xinjiang in 2009. After that, they completely shut down the internet for more than a year in that province. So when they really feel under threat, they have the ability to shut it down. But they don't want to do that because they believe that the flow of information and especially the feedback from the public to the policymakers through the internet and the media is an important value for them in two ways. One, just the functioning of a modern economy. You know, they made the decision to go from a centrally planned Stalinist style economy to a competitive market economy that's open to the world, foreign investment and trade. So there's an appreciation of the importance of having credible, accurate information about what's going on in order to make sound economic decisions. But the point that I probably emphasize more than other things that people read about the media in China is that there are senior leaders who also recognize that the flow of information and the ability to watch, to have journalists and bloggers reporting on problems at the grassroots in China is a really important thing, especially in a non-democratic country without elections. So how are they going to monitor corrupt local officials? How are they going to monitor implementation failures of environmental regulations, for example? So they rely on the commercial media and the internet to serve as watchdogs so that they can get that information and try to address problems before they generate large-scale anti-party protests. So, you know, that's why they want to use a scalpel rather than a hammer and a more blunt instrument, because they recognize that they benefit from having this kind of information feedback.
This, you know, this concept or this idea of that recognition might seem self-evident to some Western leaders, but obviously for most of Chinese modern history, this recognition didn't exist in policy. Were there events or ultimately the question is, what was happening either behind the scenes or in our faces that account for Chinese policy to have changed so radically in terms of allowing this kind of feedback loop to exist?
Well, I think probably the original argument was, if we're going to have market reform and opening to the world, we need to have a more open commercial media. And I'm pretty sure that the original argument when they opened up in 79-80 was about reducing the burden on the central treasury by letting the media go to the market. And then that we need to, in order to modernize our economy, we need to have a commercial media and allow the internet to come to China. I'm sure that's the way they thought about it. They didn't think about improving governance then. But I definitely see signs now, and I hear this in my interviews, that especially top economic officials recognize that when you do have a watchdog media and internet, it improves governance, it improves responsiveness to public concerns, and that will in turn increase support for Communist Party leaders in Beijing. So, you know, on the other hand, propaganda officials, I think, have a reflexive preference for control. More control is better. So the way I describe it is that the Chinese communist leadership, say the Standing Committee of the Politburo, appears to be ambivalent about the whether or not media feedback and internet feedback are good or just too risky. Or they may be divided. You know, it's hard for me to tell. But certainly the policies reflect these two sides, not just control, but also allowing pretty lively criticism of local officials on such topics as environmental quality, the quality of food and medicine, and other issues like that that people really care a lot about.
there have been, and we were chatting with Professor Susan Shirk at UC San Diego, there have been at least a couple of stories that I've read in the last year or last couple of years with regard to those kinds of health-related issues where it's been reported that either low-level, it seems, officials in Chinese government or even business executives and people in the business world have been executed for things like allowing impurities to get into baby formula and other things that certainly in the U.S. Might be grounds for a fine, but obviously not grounds for execution. How does the Chinese criminal justice system or legal system in particular aid or detract from this this fine-tuning, if you will, of controls of Chinese media?
Well, we have a great chapter in the book by Columbia Law professor Ben Liebman about the internet and the legal system. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of draconian punishment of officials for mistakes is very popular in China. So the legal system remains under Communist Party control. The party appoints the judges. Local officials can, you know, more or less control the verdicts of local courts. So, and then the party is so responsive to public opinion so that sometimes there's a criminal case where people start discussing it on the internet and they feel that the verdict is too light. The netizens get themselves all roiled up about this. It's a lot of discussion. And sometimes the courts respond by, on appeal, imposing a tougher sentence or even taking the poor criminal official, usually an official, away for execution. So what Ben Liebman says is that the internet discussion of criminal justice cases is impeding the institutionalization of the legal system in due process.
And do you see, as a result of the interaction or the increasing interaction of not only Chinese officials but Chinese citizens with media sources outside the U.S. causing any change in that direct control?
Well, it's important to emphasize that most people in China, the vast majority, get all their news through domestic sources. Mm-hmm. So if they have access to news stories that have been published by overseas publications, it's because somebody has then posted it on a Chinese website or it's been posted on a Chinese internet news portal or something like that. Very few people go online and read news, international news, directly. And of course, there are all sorts of impediments, the Great Firewall, that are designed to prevent people from reading international news directly as well. Now, there are ways around it, of course, and more sophisticated netizens don't have any trouble getting around it. But I think it's fair to say that it's becoming increasingly difficult. There are now rules against selling VPNs and a lot of interruption of internet access to the global internet. So that's something that we really need to watch out for.
And in the remaining 12, 13 minutes or so that we have, Susan, I do want to talk about that. You spend some time in your chapter and some of the authors as well talking about, in particular, Google and Yahoo and other internet portals, if you will. Right, these entities that have organized information on the internet and their efforts to fight censorship and control when they enter the Chinese market. Perhaps you could describe in a little more detail Google's efforts to fight censorship contrasted with entities like Yahoo. And do you see any of these companies handling these situations well?
Well, you know, a lot of the internet companies have gotten together to try to come up with a code that they will follow in their dealings with China that at least rule out some of the more egregious collaboration with the internal security apparatus in, for example, tracking down people who make speech violations of Chinese party rules and things like that. So I think Yahoo, a couple of times, has actually helped the public security people track down the sources of internet postings. And most of these companies have now agreed that that goes beyond the pale, that they won't do that. But on the other hand, when, you know, this is a huge market for people. And so when the Chinese government insists on having ways in an emergency of finding out who's saying what, who's communicating with whom, it's just very difficult for the companies to say no, that they won't kind of put it into their hardware and software. And, of course, even in the U.S., our government has that ability as well, but they only use it very sparingly and under a lot of legal supervision, although some people have argued that we're, because of concerns about terrorism, that actually the United States is not quite as good at this as they used to be. But in any case, in Google, of course, has a certain corporate value of doing no harm, and they were more reluctant than some of the other companies to cooperate with the Chinese government. So it's pretty obvious that the Chinese Communist Party just simply ran them out of town. They just threw everything they had at Google and drove them out. So, I mean, of course, Google is still there with the Android phones and things like that. But in terms of search, the basic search business, it really is pretty much nowhere in China. I mean, if you try to do a Google search in China in Chinese, it directs you to Hong Kong and then getting it in China from Hong Kong, you get a very filtered search.
Do you see, and in contrast to Google, and you mentioned Yahoo, but are there other Western companies who today are cooperating or working more closely with the Chinese government? In other words, is there? You mentioned that the industry has gotten together, but are there outliers? And are there any examples that you're aware of today of companies that are, in fact, involved in a way that, at least from a U.S. policy perspective, might make us uncomfortable?
Well, there are a lot of companies that are involved in hardware, and not just on internet, but also on all sorts of security, cameras and other security devices, ID cards. You know, it's a big business in China, the security business. And even bigger business, much bigger business than it is in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think there are a lot of companies that are marketing themselves in this way, and there's nothing in the code that would prohibit that.
Well, and So if you have a company like Cisco, for example, selling routers on the hardware side, those companies are facing specific regulation from a national security perspective and what have you that prevents some of those sales. Indeed, Cisco's VPN technology, as you mentioned, is one that cannot be easily used in other countries, and not just because of those countries' policies, but because of U.S. law. But with regard to media companies in particular, is it fair to say, at least today in 2011, that U.S. media companies as a group are not going along with these policies like they once were?
No, I think by and large, media companies continue to try to do business in China. Mm-hmm. And as I say, there are a few things that they won't do. But by and large, they are cooperating because they feel they don't have any choice. They are forming alliances with Chinese media organizations. They're very actively trying to do business in China. Google right now is really not moving forward. They're not in the game. Facebook, there's been a lot of discussion, Facebook trying to decide whether or not to try to go in and compete in social media. And the Facebook people, it's a tough decision for them. And so far they haven't been able to decide what to do. But meanwhile, the Chinese firms are booming. The Chinese firms, for example, in search, everyone said, oh, well, if Google is chased out, then Baidu, which already had the lion's share of the search market, will become the Chinese monopoly search provider. But in fact, it hasn't happened that way. There are lots of other companies now competing in search. And of course, search is getting linked more to social media. And in the microblogging has really taken off in the last year in China. And the Sina.com Weibo microblog, I've read a number of analyses that say that it's substantially better than Twitter. It offers all sorts of capabilities that you can't get on Twitter. And they have great plans for going international, Weibo does. They're already in Taiwan and Hong Kong. And, Americans could be using Weibo someday because it seems to be better designed than Twitter. So it's very competitive in China. That's the interesting thing, that it's not so monopolistic. The party and the government have allowed competition among Chinese firms. And, of course, people are making a lot of money.
With the remaining 5 or so minutes that we have, Susan, I'll ask you a normative question, which is, do you agree that these companies have no choice but to comply in China?
Well, I think it would be a big mistake for the U.S. government, for Congress, to try to tell them what to do in China. Trying to ban doing business in media and internet telecommunications in China, say that U.S. companies should not be doing that, would be very self-defeating. Because there are plenty of Chinese companies and companies from other countries that will step in and fill the gap. And I do believe that, on balance, the great expansion of information that we see in China as a result of the growth of the internet and the commercialized media is, on balance, a good thing. It's very beneficial for Chinese citizens and Chinese society. So, I think that's the overall argument of my book, is that Yes, there's censorship. Yes, there are controls. But on balance, people have more access to information in China today than they ever have, you know, since 1949 when the communists came to power. So, and it's kind of a race, of course, between the censors and the netizens and the public. And, you know, I think it's too simplistic to try to say who is winning. But every time the censors have a new technology, there seems to be some new developments on the part of ingenious netizens, you know, such as the Weibo, the microblogs, that are harder for the censors to control. So it's kind of a technological arms race between the propaganda department and the netizens. And right now, I mean, the net result of all that is that people do have a lot more information than they ever had before.
Susan, in closing, and we're recording the show on August 29th, I should say, this past weekend, the New York Times had an article, which you may have seen, involving a YouTube video that apparently was of a Chinese television show that focuses on technology in the military. That apparently showed a demonstrated attack on a non-Chinese website. And this video apparently, again, I say apparently because it was taken down, apparently showed an IP address that was a defunct American university address that had connections to Falun Gong, who, well, most listeners probably know, has been an entity that has been banned in China, a religious entity that has been banned. That video disappeared. But it was apparently a recording of a state television show. Is that where we are and where we will continue to head in China? Because I found it an interesting contrast that at the same time, apparently this show, again, I say apparently because I haven't seen it, and even the reports on it were a little hazy on whether, in fact, it was showing a cyber attack. But the fact that it was demonstrating a cyber attack and demonstrating it in the context of a state-created television show suggested that perhaps that China is acknowledging that it has these capabilities. And then apparently, once this video went outside the scope of control, it's removed from the internet by presumably Chinese authorities, although it would be interesting to know exactly how it was taken down. Is that an example of where we are in 2011? And if so, I'm not asking a crystal ball question, does media policy in China support that kind of continued action?
Well, the question of cybersecurity and kind of cyber warfare between the United States and China is a whole topic in itself that
sure.
We could talk about another time.
Right.
Our institute is doing some work on that. And, you know, it's a form of commercial and military warfare that non-state actors and state actors and hackers and all sorts of people are engaged in. So I don't really make too much of this story that we had about the report on Chinese television of what looked to me to be just sort of saying that there's a theoretical possibility of using cyber warfare as one of many weapons in the event of a conflict. It doesn't, you know, I don't think it's a big deal, frankly, that this little snippet appeared on Chinese television. So I wouldn't make too much of it.
Professor Susan Shirk of UC San Diego, editor of the book Changing Media, Changing China. Thank you for joining us in Hearsay Culture. For those that want to learn more, not only about you, but also your center, where can they go?
Well, they can go to the website, the University of California Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, or you can Google me and find my own webpage at UC San Diego.
Susan, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. Greatly enjoyed the discussion. I invite you back to, in the future to discuss this issue, which obviously is one of particular interest, not only to listeners of this show, but more broadly for those that think carefully about media policy. Thank you for putting this book together, and I look forward to chatting with you again in the future.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I'm excited to mention, although we are finishing our quarter on KZSU, that there are a number of great guests coming up in our fall quarter. For those of you that that are familiar with KZSU's schedule to any degree, you know that there are occasional interim periods on KZSU where KZSU does continue to air programming, but where I do not record new shows. However, starting in late September, we'll have new shows, and among the guests coming up are Jeremy Zimmerman of La Quadrature du Net, and I may be doing violence to the correct pronunciation of that name in French. But Jeremy is the founder of and a spokesperson for an organization that focuses on technology rights in France. Jen Nails of the People's Improv Theater will be on discussing her work and her writing on the children's stories and of books aimed at children and how technology plays there, and I'm looking forward to that discussion. Professor Lewis Hyde of Kenyon College, author of Common is Air. Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University discussing her book Privacy and Context. Andrew Renz, a research associate at the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School. Dan Hunter of New York Law School, as well as George Contreras, a visiting assistant professor at American University College of Law, and David Perlmutter of the University of Iowa discussing his books Blog War and Tenure Confidential. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can tune in Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on KZSU, and you can also stream at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show by podcast by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page or by going to Hearsay Culture's website. And you can also get the show by going to Stanford CIS's webpage, in addition to iTunes, at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And always, as always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Like I said, I am booking guests for the fall, and so any suggestions are more than welcome. And that otherwise closes this quarter on KZSU's schedule. I do want to make one special note, something I rarely do, but I want to thank Oliver Day. Oliver is a Berkman Fellow as well as an employee at Akamai. You may remember Oliver was also on KZSU and on Hearsay Culture several months ago with Derek Bambauer discussing their co-authored book, The Hacker's Aegis. If you've done a search of Hearsay Culture recently, you may have noticed that what comes up are Viagra and Cialis ads. Yes, I was the victim of a pretty sophisticated attack on Hearsay Culture's website, which basically put code into the page that created a link farm of sorts. Oliver volunteered to fix that problem, and as far as I can tell, has done it. And this volunteer work is greatly appreciated, and I want to thank Oliver publicly for doing that work, and not only for the time and the expertise that it took to get to the root of this problem, and I hope that Oliver's services will not be needed again. I also want to thank, as I always do at the end of each quarter, those that help this show go on the air, including not only KZSU's program director, but Mark Lawrence and the various DJs that man the board in my physical absence. I thank you for your time and efforts in keeping the show going, as well as my friends at Stanford Law School who convert the show from the airwave version to the podcast version, particularly Joe Nato and Elaine Adolfo, as well as my other friends at CIS who have been supporters of the show since its inception. So thank you all for making the show one that can not only air, but air professionally and air well, and I thank you for your continued efforts. That closes our show for today, closes our shows for the quarter. Thank you for listening to KZSU. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture. I look forward to chatting with you again in the fall, and enjoy the interim period. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.